but I think we have a better venue than that one. This looks quite modern, and everybody will agree with me. Even when you go to the bathrooms, you actually have a waiting room in the bathrooms where you can sit and... But also that there was an unexpected situation in the house where people actually had to be called to receive messages that you had to be in the house. But this committee had permission to proceed with the business of the day. And I therefore want to say to members, we haven't broken any rules. The house will proceed whilst our business also proceeds this side. And it's only after one that this committee, the committee members here, are required to continue because the house is sitting for the whole day today. So with those apologies, I just want to welcome the team from the South African Reserve Bank that has joined us on its a traditional appearance before the committee on its quarterly bulletin. But as usual, the team is led by the governor himself. Welcome, governor. It's been a long time. I remember the last time we were supposed to meet, our diaries clashed, and we accepted that. The committee was just a bit unhappy because, you know, when you break the tradition, people are a bit uneasy. But part of the team is also made up of Mr. Brian Khan, who also is now a familiar face in the committee. Brian Khan is the deputy head in the research unit of the Reserve Bank. We also have Ms. Nombulelo Kumata. Am I correct? Ms. Nombulelo Kumata, who is the economist in the research unit also of the bank. Ms. Samantha Henkeman. Am I correct? I'm Zulu. You know, when I see these names, I'm tempted to pronounce them in Zulu. But we also have Mr. Fanny Pakola, who is also now part of the furniture in Parliament. We did receive copies of the quarterly bulletin for September 2008 that was released to members about 2 weeks ago. We also have a hard copy of the presentation, which the bank will be talking to. So without wasting time, I'm going to allow the bank to address us on the quarterly bulletin. Governor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and the members of the committee. We appreciate that you were able to find time to meet with us. We really appreciate that. The presentation is going to be led by Brian and Nombulelo, and they will take most of the questions, and they will answer one or two questions. But they will take most of the questions. So if I could hand over, with your permission, Chair, to Brian and Nombulelo.
Okay, Mr. Khan. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Governor. We'll be giving a brief overview of the contents of the quarterly bulletin. Obviously, this is just a summary of a very in-depth analysis of the recent developments in the economy. We start off with recent international economic developments. Basically, as I'm sure we're all aware, the global economy is slowing down or showing signs of slowing down. According to the IMF forecasts, the global economy is the international economy is expected to slow down from about 5% last year to 4.1% this year and 3.9% for next year. As we see in the graph, the advanced economies in particular are bearing the brunt of the slowdown. The United States next year is expected to grow by about 0.8%, Japan 1.5%, Euro area 1.2%, and obviously they are the main drivers of the global economy and also major trading partners of South Africa. The emerging markets and developing economies are also expected to slow down, but still remain are still growing at relatively robust levels. For example, China, which grew at almost 12% last year, is expected to maintain growth at around 10% for the next year or two. With respect to consumer prices, we see that inflation has picked up in most regions of the world, mainly as a result of food and energy price increases. The brunt of the inflation increase is being borne by the emerging and developing economies. We can see that in a number of regions we're reaching double-digit inflation levels. In the advanced economies, the inflation rates have picked up slightly but are still relatively low. Clearly, it's a case of in the emerging and developing economies, there's a much bigger weight of food in the consumer basket, so the inflation rates in these regions have picked up more than in the industrialized economies. Looking at monetary policy globally, we see a bit of a change in the last few months compared to earlier on in the year, where the trend was generally for tightening monetary policy. We saw a number of countries increasing interest rates. The yellow lines here denote the countries that have reduced their rates change in interest rates. Most of these countries have been experiencing inflation and declining growth, and the concern for the declining growth has resulted in either a loosening of monetary policy or in some instances, for example, in the euro area, where it was widely expected that they would be raising rates, they've kept rates on hold. With respect to inflation in the SADC region, here again we see, as in the earlier table on inflation rates, we see that most of the SADC countries are experiencing inflation rates in double-digit territory or close to that. Now, moving on to commodity price developments, here we see the Brent crude oil prices, which at the beginning of the year were around about $80 or $90. It then increased quite significantly to about $145, $146 in early July, and since then we've seen quite a sharp downtick. In the last few weeks it reached levels below $90 per barrel. Unfortunately, yesterday we saw the single biggest increase in crude oil prices. I think at one point crude oil had jumped by about $25 per barrel and ended the day at about $120. So that's this nice picture that we're seeing here in terms of crude oil prices has moved from down here to back to about this level here. I haven't seen what has happened this morning. The good news on the crude oil front is, I suppose, bad news for the other economy, other commodities from our perspective, from South Africa's perspective. As commodity prices in general come down, we get affected by that, and we can see that platinum prices, which were in excess of $2,000 per ounce for much of this year, to date in July, in line with oil price declines and commodity prices in general, we've seen quite a big decline in platinum prices to about $1,200 per ounce yesterday, although they're still at relatively high levels compared to recent experience. But there's no doubt that commodity prices are a bit under pressure as a result of the slowing global economy. The behavior of the gold price has been slightly different because gold is not purely a commodity for the sake of a commodity, but it's also an asset, and therefore there has been a lot of demand for gold, particularly over the last few days. We've seen a resurgence of the gold price as increased uncertainty in the international financial markets has affected the demand for gold. Now, moving on to the recent domestic economic developments, here we see that The growth rate of the South African economy increased to 4.9% on a quarter-on-quarter annualized basis in the second quarter, compared to 2.1% in the first quarter. Now, that 2.1% in the first quarter came about mainly because of the impact of the constraints on electricity supplies. So in the second quarter, when we had a rebound, it exaggerated that that impact. Just to give you an example, in the first quarter, mining growth contracted by 25% and then increased by 15.6% in the second quarter. Manufacturing contracted by 1% in the first quarter and increased from that low base to 14.5% in the second quarter. The tertiary sector, which was less affected by the electricity supply constraints, grew at 4.2% in the first quarter and then down to 1.4% in the second quarter. So overall, there has been, in the first two quarters of this year, some moderation in the growth rate compared to the 5% average we've been seeing for the previous 4 years. Now, moving on to the expenditure, we see that expenditure grew by 14.2% in the first quarter of this year and then contracted by 4.2% this year, and we'll go through some of those components, and we'll see it's an across-the-board moderation in expenditure. Firstly, if we look at real final consumption expenditure by households, consumption expenditure had been growing at levels close to 10% in 2006. Since then, in response to higher interest rates and declining real income, real disposable income growth, we've seen quite a large moderation in domestic consumption expenditure. In the first quarter of this year, it contracted; it had fallen to 3.3%, and only grew by 1.2% in the second quarter of this year. The bulk of the decline in expenditure was felt with respect to durable goods consumption. Durable goods consumption contracted; contracted by 8% in the first quarter, and by 15% in the second quarter. So the interest-sensitive components of expenditure have been under pressure. As I mentioned, one of the factors determining this decline in household consumption expenditure has been a declining growth in real disposable income of households. Now, I suppose a positive development has, that we've seen in the latest figures is that household debt, in other words, total indebtedness of households relative to their disposable income, has for the first time in a long time declined. It reached a peak in the first quarter of 78%. It is now at 76.7%. So the ratio of total household debt to disposable income is showing signs of moderation. However, the cost of servicing that debt, as we can see in this graph, is still on the up in line with higher interest rates.
As you can see, you know, the staff talk about higher interest rates, and Professor Khan was saying, but the governors talk about the tighter monetary conditions. So there's a subtle difference there, but the staff are in charge, but governors talk about tighter monetary conditions or looser monetary conditions. They don't mention interest rates, but the staff, they do.
We could also mention the less accommodative monetary policy stance.
Okay, even though the prof is also still going to explain that even though the household debt is actually coming down, the debt service cost is actually on the upside. Okay. But proceed, we'll get an explanation later.
Thank you. With respect to government consumption expenditure, we've seen a decline in the second quarter, and again that's because the reversal of the first quarter increase. The first quarter increase, as you can see, was around 14%, and that was because of the submarine that was acquired during that quarter. And as you're probably aware, government consumption, procurement of arms falls under consumption expenditure rather than capital expenditure in the national income accounts. So that has had a distorting effect on the second quarter number. Now, moving on to investment expenditure, we see that real gross fixed capital formation increased by 17% in the first quarter and then came down to 9% in the second quarter, but still at a relatively robust level. What has been quite gratifying is that over the last few years we've seen quite a strong increase in investment in the investment to GDP ratio, which has now increased to about 22.5% compared to about 13% for 2002-2003. And then just briefly looking forward, we see that the composite leading business cycle indicator has been on a very moderate downward trend since the middle of 2007, and we are now seeing the economy slowing down in line with the expectation from the leading indicator. Moving on to the labour market, there is a slide that was not here that was in the pack, which looks at the employment numbers, and we see that according to the new quarterly labour force survey, the latest unemployment rate for South Africa for June for the second quarter of this year is 23%. Now there are obviously problems of consistency in some of these surveys because these surveys have been revised and improved over time, but we do get a general picture that shows that unemployment peaked in the second quarter, in 2002 at about 30% and is now down to 23%. It's still high, but in line with a higher growth rate, we have seen a steady decline in the unemployment rate. With respect to wage settlements, we see again that in line with a high inflation rate, that nominal wage settlements have increased. According to the latest survey, for the first half of the year, average level of wage settlements was 8.3%, which is quite a bit lower than the prevailing inflation rate. So in effect, we've seen a decline in real wages, whereas during the period when we had very low inflation, we saw that the wage settlements actually exceeded the inflation rate. So this shows that in effect that what has tended to happen is that during low inflation periods, real wages have increased and wages haven't quite kept up with inflation during the high inflation period. Now moving on to the inflation rates, firstly producer prices. We've seen quite a big increase in the producer price index since the beginning of the year. The most recent number was 18.9% in July. I should mention, however, that there was a change in the way and the definition of the producer price index at the beginning of this year, so the numbers since the beginning of this year are not strictly comparable with those beforehand. For example, exported goods such as commodities weren't part of the producer price index in the past. They are now, and with the higher commodity prices, that clearly puts upward pressure on that number. Moving on to consumer prices, here we see that both the headline and the CPIX inflation continue to exceed the inflation target range. The latest number for CPIX is 13% for July and 13.4% for the headline inflation. This was driven mainly by food and energy. In fact, for the last year, food prices have contributed about 45% of the increase in inflation that we've experienced over the past year. But it's not only food and energy. If we exclude food and petrol from CPIX, in July, the number was 7.4% compared to 6.2% the previous month, and that big jump in that core index came about because of the higher electricity prices that came into effect from July. In looking at the balance of payments, here we do see some improvement with respect to the current account, where the deficit of the current account to the balance of payments narrowed slightly from 8.9% in the first quarter of 2008 to 7.3% in the second quarter. And that was mainly as a result of an improved performance in the export sector. As we see in this graph, the volume of mining exports picked up quite considerably in the second quarter. The first quarter was a bad quarter for mining exports because of the electricity constraints again, but then it picked up quite nicely in the second quarter. We also saw the volume of manufacturing exports also increasing substantially in the second quarter, mainly coming from motor vehicle exports and machinery and electrical equipment. Whether we can sustain that in a declining world economy, that's something that we'll have to see. With respect to the financing of the deficit, we can see that there hasn't been a problem to date with financing the deficit. In the second quarter of this year, the financial account had a surplus of 44 billion rand, and 27 billion rand of that was made up of portfolio investment inflows. At the same time, the bank has continued to increase its holdings of gold and other foreign exchange reserves. In July, gross reserves increased to $35 billion, and the international liquidity position to about $33 billion. That number came down a bit in August, but that was purely as a result of revaluation, that as the dollar strengthened during that month, the holdings, the dollar value of our other of reserves, such as euros or pound sterling, therefore declined, and therefore we had a downward valuation adjustment with respect to other currencies and also with respect to gold. The exchange rate, having been fairly stable in 2007, we saw a large depreciation in the first quarter of this year, particularly in January. Since then, there has been some appreciation in the exchange rate, but since the beginning of the year, the trade-weighted value of the rand has declined by between 13 and 14%. With respect to developments in the money markets, firstly, the money supply figures, we see that money supply growth has been on a slight downward trend, but still at levels of around 20%. The total loans and advances to the private sector, here we see, has been also coming from a very high level of around 30%. We've seen a decline also to around 20% growth in the most recent quarter, and that's consistent with the declining rate of growth of household debt that we saw earlier on. In the money market, short-term interest rates have moved in line with the increases in the repo rate. This orange line is the repurchase rate. And we see that the three-month rates have been increasing in line with that. But in terms of future expectations, the forward rate agreements show that the market expects short-term rates to be declining over the next year or so. Moving on to the capital markets, share prices have declined significantly since their highs in May of this year. There's been a 24% approximate decline in the all-share index. Here we see the value in terms of rand, and the blue line is the dollar value of shares. This decline in the JSE has been in tandem with the decline in global markets as well. The property market has also remained under pressure. We've seen that according to the APSA House Price Index, year-on-year increase in the average size house is now down to 1.7%. That's the year-on-year rate. The month-on-month rate, in fact, is negative. So house prices on a month-on-month basis are actually falling on average. And in real terms, we've seen a 10% decline in real terms of houses. And then finally, on the government side, fiscal policy remains under control and poses no problem at this point for monetary policy. There is some expectation of a higher borrowing requirement in the coming years to finance the infrastructure expenditure. We then also have a few graphs just of a longer term nature, looking at some recent domestic economic developments over time. Firstly, looking at the repo rate and CPIX, we see that the repo rate has, despite the change in monetary policy stance over the last couple of years, we've seen that the repo rate has been probably relatively more stable than the period in the late 90s. Inflation, we had the peak in 2002 as a result of the food price and exchange rate developments in late 2001, and then the prolonged period of inflation stability before the recent increase in inflation. The longer-term perspective on growth, we also see, as I mentioned earlier, that growth had been averaging around 5% for the last three or four years, compared to much lower rates of growth in the late 90s and the early 2000s. Gross fixed capital formation as a percentage of gross domestic product. Again, I'd mentioned it earlier when we were looking at the quarterly figures, and this is probably the good news of the South African economy over the last few years has been the significant increase in the investment to GDP ratio, which has come from levels of just over 14% in 2002 to about 23% currently. And then finally, the other development of note has been the change in the holdings of foreign gold and foreign exchange reserves from a negative position in 1998 to a very positive position currently. Thank you, Chair. That is the end of the presentation.
Thank you. Are there any additions from the rest of the team? Perhaps the Governor would want to round off, or any other members of the team?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much, Brian, for that good summary. And those last graphs that Brian showed there are telling the South African story much on a longer-term basis, so that people mustn't forget what has been achieved in the past 10 years. So scientifically, you can demonstrate if on page 18, when you look at that first graph there, gross fixed capital formation as a percentage of GDP, it tells a good story. And that's a story that our people need to hear, so that they're not depressed, because a lot of achievement has been made here. So when people say, but this economy has been a disaster, people at the helm of the management of the economy have been a disaster, it's not true. Scientifically, we need to be able to point to that achievement. And then also the second graph on page 18 shows that in 1998, we had no reserves at all. And now we're standing in a position where we have close on $34 billion US dollars in reserves. We didn't have that. It was a disaster. for, major achievement for the South African economy, which will partially as well explain the performance of other components of the market. And on page 17, it's also a story that we must tell with confidence. When people say, but this African Reserve Bank is made up of mad bureaucrats whose policy is only to tighten monetary policy, we need to indicate to them that actually the inflation rate now...
Can I interrupt the governor?
Oh.
I've just received a message that the bells of Parliament are ringing. And our permission to meet was based on the fact that we would be able to respond to that call. Can I request
adjournment?
10-minute break, and we're going to come back and proceed.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Our apologies.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much.
The first is in the presentation, and you are around. We can start with the questions. If there are questions that really require the governor's attention, we will allow him time to do that. So in the interest of time, I'm going to allow members of the committee to ask questions in relation to the quarterly bulletin that is before us. I see Dr. George's hand, Mr. Mare's hand, Mr. Mungoni's hand. Ms. Fabs is still going to read the report. You take your time. Take your time. Dr. George.
Thank you, Chair. As we saw from the presentation, that some countries are loosening their monetary policy to stimulate the economy as it slows down. This is obviously not possible in South Africa right now. And my question is, will the bank further tighten monetary policy if inflation does not moderate in South Africa? And then the global credit crunch, we have seen that there have been some major casualties in the international financial system. And South African banks appear to be less affected. But does the Reserve Bank really know the extent of the South African bank's exposure? And how does it know this? And then finally, you mentioned the value of the rand. What are the most important immediate term influences that are impacting on the value of the rand? Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Mr. Murray.
Thank you, Chair. My first question is just on the growth in the real gross fixed capital formation. And I just want to know that that's fairly high or the buoyant level that we're still on. To what extent is that due to the 2010 projects and constructions? And if it has got a relation with that, what do you expect to happen after that? That's my first question. Then my second one to the governor. We know that in terms of the formula and the composition of the basket from January 2009, that gives us a different underlying inflation currently. Now, and we know that there's lots of debates and controversy that has been wind around that. How does this influence your consideration on repo rates now and in the future? And my third one is we know that the growth of the economy in the past has been to a large extent demand driven, which we know that was an imbalance of with the supply side. We have seen the household debt coming down. We see that the debt service cost has gone up. We've seen the disposable income on households has gone down due to inflation and the value of the rand. We have seen the production prices of business has gone up. We have seen the cost of imports going down, which is to a certain extent a disincentive for local producers manufacture and also to employ eventually. My question is, to what extent are we prepared and ready for a broad-based, and I put the emphasis on a broad-based, supply-side driven economic growth in the future? And you know, how can we make sure that, because eventually you will have the consumers, they must be prepared to spend eventually as well, in balance, obviously. And with all those downside trends, to what extent, you know, are we ready to stimulate that in the correct manner? Thank you, sir.
Mr. Mgwene.
Thanks, Chair. Somewhere in the bulletin on the economic outlook, I just can't find the exact page, but I think I read somewhere where it refers as the resilient South African economy to global crunch. I just want to find out what's the risk of in the market, seeing that, you know, there's been a purchase of some of the South African banks by international banks. Now, if we say the economy is resilient to credit crunch, what's the risk that is posed by the purchase, like a Barclays Bank by other banks and you know, the Bank of China? What risks are we facing? My second question, Chair, is in relation to the policy change. The governor is free to respond to the question. But there's should I say an outcry as I listen to the news in the US or in Washington to say there's political risk in South Africa because of change of administration. Now the EU said it's a maturing democracy. I just want to find out what's the risk that are we facing as far as this issue is concerned, and linking it to the current account deficit, of which IMF have said also said that it is now seen as a risk by most outside investors in South Africa. Thanks, Chair.
Mr. Mulata. Thank you, Chair. My first question would relate more to the international situation. I just want to find out from the governor, I mean, the lessons that we can learn from what is emanating from the U.S., the use of the land of last resort. I'll just point certain issues without going into them into detail. The use of the land of last resort, issues of moral hazard, and coming back slightly to the question of Mr. Mguni, your own internal financial stability report, I would assume you do an industry-wide analysis of the risks. How certain are we that some of the issues that emerge from there, there's not a spillover into the South African financial system? Sure, the other issue, I'm sorry I kept on going in and out because of what was happening in the House. I would want to also pose a question around the issue of bond yields, which is important as an indicator of what investors, their expectations, their inflation expectations. What are the trends there? Are we seeing any downward trend or upward trend? Chair, the other issue also raised by Mr. Mguni is the issue of the financing of the current account deficit. You indicate that we are still in a good picture because we get good inflows. But the question that I might pose, but which might border on policy matters, which I know the governor always would want to stay away from, it's the financing of the deficit, in case we go into a deficit. I would assume that it's getting quite expensive to go and borrow out there. I mean, if you check that banks can't loan to each other, the interbank rate has gone up because people are not sure what you have on your balance sheet, on your books, whether you have the bad asset-backed securitized, securities on your... So for me, it's an other issue that I would want the governor to give us an opinion. I think that's all, Chair.
Yeah, let's keep it there. I think we have quite a number.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Before the bells started sounding, I was trying to say something, which I couldn't say. And that something I wanted to say would have dealt with some of the issues that have been raised. But let me say that thing I wanted to say. I traveled very far to be here, so from all the way from Limpopo to here. So I have to say what I wanted to say. It's very far. I'm going back there just now. I was saying that if you look at that graph, which shows where the monetary policy stance is vis-à-vis the rate of increase in the general prices, you see the red line is beginning to cross the blue line. So if you then give a narrow interpretation of what real interest rates are, it shows that we might be going into negative territory. So the argument that there's high interest rates doesn't hold. If you look at the technical issues, doesn't hold. So, but of course, there are different measures of what real interest rates are. You have to look at the expected interest rates versus also the expected inflation rate and so on. But narrowly, it might mean that we are running the risk of negative real interest rates. That's not good for investment, as you know. So I hope members will help me in explaining that to the population. The second issue I wanted to raise was, if you were to wake me up in the morning and say, Governor, what is it that is of great concern to you today? I'll probably answer as follows. Firstly, that I'm concerned about the global financial market instability. Its origin we've discussed before, being the U.S. housing market in particular, the subprime market. We've discussed that before, so there's no need to revisit it. But the situation is getting worse. I was looking at my notes of when we last discussed this in March. I have a special notebook that I bring here. So I was looking at those notes, and we discussed that thing in March. And we expressed concern, and that was on the 27th of March, we expressed concern about the developments in the subprime market in the U.S. That problem has not gone away. And therefore, our colleagues in the U.S. and Europe have had to intervene in the money market in order to facilitate the continued smooth running of the banks. As Mr. Moloto says, the banks don't want to deal with one another. You can see that interbank rates is shot up and nobody wants to provide interbanking funds to the other. We haven't seen the last of this, as I was saying, and it's of concern. Now, so the arguments about moral hazards and land of last resort, all those textbook questions have been challenged to the core. So you can talk intellectually about moral hazard and this and that, it doesn't mean anything. What is of relevance is, what central banks are going to do to keep the financial system working. To the extent that most banks have run out of the traditional collateral that we used to know, and central banks are even willing to accept credit cards and student loans and stock as collateral. So the thing that is in the money and banking textbook is out of the window. We have to write new textbooks. And the key issue is how to keep the financial system going. We've had situations where some of our colleagues have had to rescue non-bank financial institutions by providing liquidity to banks in order for those banks to purchase non-banking financial institutions. Because, and this argument about too big to fail, it's all textbook matters. What matters now is that the central banks have to make judgment on the spot. Do we allow bear dens to collapse, the consequence of which might also consume banking institutions, or do we find a way to rescue it in order to try and stabilize the financial system? And those are no longer academic arguments, they're practical issues. Now, so that would be the first issue that would, I would say, would concern me. The second one is the inflationary picture. Again, we don't need to repeat what we've discussed before and Brian has discussed. That's still of concern. And the important point that Brian Kahn was making is that even when we exclude food and energy, the inflation rate is running at above 7%. So anybody who goes around arguing that these are just exogenous shocks is not arguing from an educated point of view. You must say, Lord, forgive them, for they know not what they are saying. Because it's not true. At a scientific level, and facts are confusing to other people. But we have to operate on the basis of scientific facts. I was at the conference in Jackson Hole last month, organized by the Kansas City Fed. And the colleagues there are talking now about the post-securitization period. Because all these securitized assets, nobody wants them. So this excitement that we had over the years from investment bankers about the securitized items, it's gone out of the window. And some central banks are finding themselves sitting with these things that nobody wants to buy. And once you have a situation where there are assets whose value is unknown, because there's no trading, then you have a big problem in the market. And that's why some colleagues, as I say, are talking about the post-securitization period. Others are even talking about the post-investment banking period. Because you have some of the biggest investment banks in the world now applying to become deposit-taking institutions, no longer operating as simple investment banks. Because it's becoming very difficult to be an investment bank. So those are the difficulties we have, and we have the inflation problem. There's a question about monetary policy. What's going to happen when there's a rebasing and a consolidation of the CPI figures next year? The answer is, I don't know. But our simulations indicate that inflation will still be higher than expected. We'll come off the bat, but it will only be inside the target band somewhere in 2010, right? Second quarter of 2010. So the situation out there is still very serious, and we have to attend to that. I can say more about that. On the broad-based supply-driven structural changes, I couldn't agree more with the need for that. And again, you might remember over the years I've kept on arguing for the need for structural changes in the economy, which might also lift up the potential output for South Africa, say from about 4.5, maybe higher, but we need a lot of structural changes. Government supported, private sector driven, technology driven, labor market driven, and so on. So I agree with that. About the resilience of the South African economy, I suspect what Brian and them were saying is that despite this slowdown in the global economy, the South African economy has been able to grow at or around potential, 3.5, 4.5, thereabout. That's not bad in the current circumstances. It's not bad performance at all. You saw when Brian was showing how other economies are performing, particularly the so-called developed economies. Not bad at all. But I don't advocate the theory of decoupling. In other words, what happens in the U.S. won't influence us. And I've argued before in the House, in the committee, why I think that's not the case. But the banking sector in South Africa is relatively okay. And again, in the past, I've explained that. Some of the international franchises of South African banks may be somewhat exposed to the subprime market, but the main houses in Johannesburg are not really exposed. So to that extent, it's okay. Strange as it might sound, we might have to thank exchange controls for that. Strange as it might sound, but I don't have time to explain. There's a question about risk and the political things. I think let me take the Fifth Amendment on that. What I can say at a technical level is that non-residents have been net sellers of equities and bonds, I think yesterday, to the tune of some 34 billion rand year to date. And we're now September, so we're left with October, November, December. So it seems that for the year as a whole, we might be in negative territory. It does raise questions about the financing of the current account deficit, but Brian, I think, explained what is happening there. So Brian maybe will talk a bit about the bond yields, but I think those were the issues that I thought maybe I should talk about, and Brian will deal with all the other complicated questions.
Prof, take your bite.
Thank you. I think the governor has answered quite a lot of the questions. There was a question about gross fixed capital formation and the extent to which these are focused on 2010 projects and what will happen happen after that. I think it's difficult to disentangle capital investment projects from 2010 and from normal projects. I think some of the projects were going to happen anyway. Perhaps 2010 has focused the completion date to be a bit nearer rather than later. For example, the Gautrain trying to get ready in time for 2010 rather than beyond that. But I think that the if you look at the list of projects that are being undertaken, which range from transportation, road, rail, etc., the ports, investment in electricity, which is going to carry on for quite a good few years, I think that it's clear that come 2010 there's still going to be a lot of infrastructure that has to construction that has to take place. So I think the view is that although some of these projects will reach completion, particularly construction of stadiums, I suppose, has to be done off by then. But I think a lot of the broader infrastructure projects will continue beyond there. And I think if you look at the outlook, the 5 to 7 year outlook for these, it looks like we'll be going well beyond 2010. So I don't think it's a simple case that come 2010 suddenly all investment is going to end. With respect to the, I think there was a question on the bond yields and inflation expectations. I think what we have seen generally, not only from the bond yields but from other surveys on inflation expectations, that during 2007 there was a general upward drift in inflation expectation, and it was reflected to some extent in the bond yields, but the inflation expectation survey of the Bureau for Economic Research also showed that a slight upward drift in inflation expectations, but by the beginning of 2008 we saw quite a big jump in inflation expectations, and that was reflected in the surveys of the BER, also in the bond rates and the break-even inflation rates, which derive expectations from the inflation-linked bonds. So generally we have seen, until about the middle of this year, we saw quite a sharp uptick in expectations. Since the middle of the year, there has been a bit of moderation. And generally what we're seeing is that from later this year till and going through next year, there is an expectation that inflation will start coming down. That is in line with our own forecasts as well. So the longer term rates are reflecting that to to some extent. I think there was also a question on what are the main factors that determine the value of the rand. I think that is a difficult question. There are a whole range of factors. Some are more important at some time than in other times, but there's no one factor that we can give you a whole list of possible factors like commodity prices, interest rates, growth rates, etc. But I think different variables are more important at different points in time. Some affect exchange rate on the day, some are more longer term impact. So I think it's very difficult to be able to point to one or two major factors that are going to impact on the exchange rate. I think as far as I can see, the from my list, I think most of the questions have been covered.
Unless if there are members that feel that their questions were not adequately dealt with. If not, we will proceed. I've got two more hands. I've got Ms. Mokoto and Mr. Johnson, Ms. Fabs, Mr. Mungoni, and Mr. Malahle.
Chair, I'll read on behalf of Ms. Mokoto. She has lost her voice.
But we only went to vote. We did not sing. What happened? Okay, go ahead. Do it for him.
On behalf of Ms. Mokoto, question one, where do I start? Okay. What asymmetries exist on the South African Reserve Bank's monetary policy? What asymmetries exist in the South African Reserve Bank monetary policy? Do you think we can correct them, and how soon? The second question: so far we saw major outflows of investments from South Africa. How huge is the impact in the economy? The last question is: what are the positives of the negatives mentioned in the responses given by the governor?
Okay, you know, it's the difficulty with third party. yeah, but if the questions were not clear, the governor and the team would request clarity.
But anyway, between the two surnames, Mr. Mokoto and Mr. Moloto, the difference is just between, is that like the difference between Obama and Osama? It's just one letter. Okay. Then next was Mr. Johnson.
Chair, thanks. Two quick ones. One is very small. Just clarity, perhaps, on the wage settlements on page 8. And more for me is about sustainability, wherein you have both the headline inflation and the CPIX far above, you know, settlement rates that have been agreed upon. And the interest for me there is the sustainability of such, so that you don't find a situation where you are shocked by another wave of negotiations that are going to point into a different direction, which could effectively work above those two. The last point, Chair. Our own governor, first year or two, you'll be correct, was voted best central banker. We took our reserves from minus 28 to current 34 billion. The management of our monetary policy from the highs some years to the lows before the global trends, especially they affect the oil prices and the food prices. Now, the interest on my part, you also alluded to some other areas, you know, of achievements. We have heard, you know, your bashers and detractors in the form of COSATU and the Communist Party. I'm failing to understand, maybe the first point there is whether do you have any contact or regular contact, however regular it could be, with such formations, COSATU, Communist Party, so that perhaps as they go about doing their bashing, they are doing so informed. Do you have such regular contacts? And I, in my own view, I have strong views, basically, especially on information that really does not reach out to some of them. I would then say it's very unfair on the part of some of those formations, and perhaps underlying that all of those would be the kind of contact and interactions that are there, whether structured or not.
Okay, the next was Ms. Phelps.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you very much. I'm just apologies to the Governor for missing the presentation, but one was otherwise occupied with House business. Chairperson, just on this issue of the relative price of food, I want to look at that, as well as the cost of electricity. And the cost of electricity relative to the increase or decline of output, productivity, which has been referred to. And then just in passing on the housing situation, some years ago, the governor, or perhaps it was just 2 years ago, the governor did caution to the Portfolio Committee on Finance against what he called speculative investment or buying in housing, and was at pains to warn South Africans about this habit. Of course, he was not heeded at that time. And now we're sitting with quite a few serious problems. But forgetting the speculative side, the reality is that many more people have bought houses, one-house families, and the interest rate relative to that purchase, and shall we say, the stability in the wage trajectory, together with the food inflation, which is referred to in some way here, the electricity hike in tariff. Where does that really take us? And when just breezing through the presentation booklet that we've got here, we see that we have now got tighter money, and that yes, there is a lower, people are sort of using less credit. In other words, some of the issues that central bankers would be concerned with on the domestic front have been met. And yet, and this comes my question, I'm sorry I've had to pose it in this manner, but I just wanted to flesh out my thinking, Chairperson.
Setting a very bad example, because some people might want to emulate.
I'm glad I came in the middle then, Chair, sorry. So that I'm not retraining Mr. Johnson on that front. But the issue then is, faced with all of what I would call fairly significant hurdles for the average man on the street economically, and those of even lower income, what would you be saying to them at this point? Because they can't squeeze in their belts, you know, tighten those belts anymore. There's no other notch. They've still got to travel to get to work, but they can't afford to travel to get to work. And very soon, they can't afford the electricity hike. What would your advice be? Thank you, Governor.
Okay, Ms. Fabs, you can't say you're in the middle. You know, there's still five more hands after you. And I don't know whether it's because of what the governor said. We've just picked up this. Somebody has decided to get rid of his credit card. It's not actually a credit card. It's a card that stops, that is used for stopping cards. But I don't know. I don't know what you said. Okay, because it doesn't have a name. Okay, I'm not too sure whether we should be taking these questions, because we have 5 names, five more hands. Perhaps we should be responding to these questions so that we do not crowd you with a lot of questions. Let's take responses, even though in the interest of time we might be very pressed now. But go ahead.
Thank you very much. I'm afraid I didn't quite understand the first question, so I'll leave it to Brian Khan.
Yep, Mr. Mloto had actually made an offer to rephrase some of the questions.
Okay.
Because he was reading them down, and he made a number of errors.
Yes, I know. He might probably have been, as he was reading, translating into Sepedi, and he got himself confused in the process. But let me deal with the second question, which has to do with the non-resident participation in our economy and the implications thereof, which I tried to explain earlier, that year-to-date non-residents have been net sellers of equities and bonds. Now, one can read their behavior in many ways. And one of the ways to read that is that, given the global financial situation, there's a tendency by investors to withdraw their investments from places they might be uncomfortable with, i.e. emerging markets, and investing those in places that they feel they've got more confidence in. And of course, one of the interesting things is that people tend to be buying U.S. treasuries, and yet the center of the problem is there. But they have confidence that whatever happens, the American system will be resilient going forward. Whilst they might not be certain about what is going to happen in India or China or Nigeria or other places, Kenya and so on. So the smooth changes that one can pick up from time to time. And that's why it is so important for people to try and support what central banks are trying to do. Because we're doing our best to try and stabilize the world financial system, and we could do with a little bit of help from other players as well. But wage settlements, I'll leave that to Brian to sort out. And then about the question that Honorable Johnson is raising about the contacts between the bank and other stakeholders in South African society, it's a very important question, which we take seriously. You might recall that about 9 years ago, we introduced the system of monetary policy forums so that everybody is welcome to those forums to express whatever view they have. There are some individuals who, no matter how prominent they might be, have chosen not to attend those forums, but shout the loudest outside. They never come in because the facts might be too confusing if they participate in the discussions. It was much better to issue statements, the uninformed, uneducated from outside. But we continue to want to interact with people, and those forums are open. Each member of the Monetary Policy Committee has been allocated to a province where they must go to the factories and the mines and understand the real economic dynamics, talk to people, listen to their concerns, and so on. I think one of the most interesting of this journeys was what Brian Kahn and somebody, was it you, Brian? You went to the Northern Cape to some, was it you or Bertus? Those Bertus from say, went very far away in the Northern Cape and then discovered that the concern of the local mine manager had nothing to do with inflation at all. We just worried that the railway track is not working very well. That's his main concern. So there are these interactions, and we try our best. And then, you know, I regularly phone people to talk to them about things and invite people to the bank to exchange information and discussions. And sometimes people cancel at the last meeting, at the last minute. You've made all arrangements for people and everything else, and they just cancel, just don't pitch. And no sense of any responsibility. But the job of the central bank is always to maintain contact with all stakeholders, and we have to continue to do that, to exchange this information. For example, when people say they don't understand that graph about inflation and interest rates, we have to be in a position to try and explain that. But I understand that economics is a little bit too intimidating because it's a structured science, and you need to be systematically taken through the science so you understand what is the horizontal axis and what is the vertical axis and why do they meet there and what does this thing mean. You need to have a sense of the statistical history and the construction of this to be able to make sense out of it. It's a structural thing. You don't wake up in the morning and suddenly, out of the blue, issue an economic policy statement without having gone through the structure and the science of it. It's like me going to issue a statement about heart surgery. What do I know about that? Nothing. But it's systematically taken through the issue. So some people feel intimidated, but those who have patience, they give themselves the time to get to learn about the science, and it's our duty to encourage that. The questions that Mrs. Phelps raised.
Can I just check whether the question also on the asymmetry of information did not border on that? Because if Mr. Mloto clarifies it further, it'll perhaps link to that. Was that the point?
Sir, I've been given a new brief after consultation. Chair, the question on asymmetries, the question was basically, what does monetary policy to address? No, what our monetary policy seeks to address can at times contradict our national obligations as a country. How do we reconcile the two? And the last question, which was not clear, and after further consultation, Chair, I can state that the question says that given what the Governor has mentioned on market volatility, investment banks changing into deposit-taking institutions, and of securitizations, what would be the positives that can come out of this experience? I hope I've represented my client well.
No, thanks. It's just that I wanted to make sure that, you know, whilst the governor was at it, we don't lose those. Okay. Proceed, Governor.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm happy that now I understand the question. Thank you very much for that. What are the national goals and how do they relate to monetary policy? So the democratically elected government, within its rights, decides that South Africa will have an inflation targeting monetary policy framework and stipulates that the target will be the consumer price index minus mortgage costs, which must stay within the band of 6 to 3%. So that is the goal that's set. And as we've discussed before, it then becomes the responsibility of everybody to contribute what they can towards the achievement of that goal. Whether it's about electricity pricing, about health and education fees, municipal rates and taxes, and all of that becomes our joint collective responsibility. So to make sure that the task of monetary policy is also assisted by this joint effort, by everybody. And also in the process to ensure that there's no confusion about what the central task of the central bank is. Central bank does not run factories and mines and industries. The central bank is not the Industrial Development Corporation. It is not the Department of Trade and Industry. It is not the Department of Agriculture, and so on. It's responsible primarily for monetary policy, which monetary policy must contribute towards low inflation in the interest of sustainable economic growth and development. Sustainable economic growth and development does not take place within the context of high inflation. You know, I have in my pocket here a note from a country that I won't mention, which makes me a billionaire. It says $100 billion. It's in my ear. But if I show you, these guys will show which country it is. But and that is the result of inflation. It can't be the goal of a country to increase inflation. You end up with everybody being a billionaire like that. And yet this $100 billion can't even buy me a cup of coffee. That's high inflation. So it can't be the goal of the country. It's not sustainable. So the job of monetary policy really is to contribute towards low inflation. And once there's low inflation, clearly the monetary conditions will be more accommodative and so on. But it brings me close to what Ms. Fab said. I'll come back to the deposit-taking institutions. Quite correct. It should be in the interest of this country that there should be a growth, in particular of the black middle class. But the middle class in general, it's quite correct. That will contribute a great deal to the further development of our economy. So, it is quite correct to expect that people should buy houses, and the general improvement in the structure of their living conditions. Very important, that. But that doesn't mean that when I know that my income is X amount,
but my expenditure is X plus 10. Then there's trouble brewing. And so, we can't, all of us then can't then be blamed for the actions of people who have been irresponsible from the start. And when that happens, as I've said before in this committee, one must reorganize one's portfolio. That's life. There's something in economics called the budget constraint. All of us have that. I can't just seek to impress the neighbors when I don't know what the source of income for the neighbors is. I can't compete with the Joneses where I don't know where the income comes from. I must live within my means. I shouldn't say anything further, but the lesson to be learned is that people must not overcommit themselves. It's difficult to say so. Some people don't like me to say this, but I consider this part of my, duty as the high priest of monetary policy to say these things, despite the ridicule that sometimes comes with the Sunday newspapers. We just have to ignore that and proceed with what is correct. Yes, she wants to say something. So the interest rate position is relevant to the extent that it is trying to help contain inflation. That's the important thing. But Ms. Kumati wants to say something.
No, I just wanted to just support what the governor has said in terms of what the data. Okay. I just want to support what the governor says in terms of data. I think we should rid ourselves of the notion that high inflation leads to growth. The sooner we start from the playing field that high inflation is a resultant of high interest rates, as the governor showed that if you have high interest rates, you have to have high interest rates so that you can have a positive real rate. So let us rid ourselves of the notion that high interest rates are a result of high growth. If we have been in a situation for the past 4 or 5 years where we've had the repurchase rate very low, we had CPIX within the target range, so the target per se is not the issue to be debated. We can grow at rates of above 5% with inflation low, and we've seen that jobs can be created. It's a matter of structural changes, and we have seen that the indicators are showing that the economy is on the right track. We've seen that gross capital formation is growing as a percentage of GDP. That on its own is going to unblock bottlenecks. As a result, we are going to lift the potential output and we'll be out of this hitch. We've been here before, so there's nothing to cry about.
So they're more stronger than me. The last question about the deposit-taking institutions, and then Brian will deal with the others together with Ms. Kumati. Is there anything positive that might be coming out from the request by some investment bankers that they become deposit-taking institutions? I think there's some good that might come out of it. You see, I think the investment bankers had also run too ahead of themselves, selling things which they didn't know. We've discussed this, I think, in the last meeting about these securitized items. Maybe they got ahead of themselves a bit. And the good thing about being a formally regulated deposit-taking institution is that it brings a lot of discipline and order and procedure. Most of us do no longer know who our bank manager is. And when you ask the old timers and the old ladies, they'll tell you that they used to go to the bank manager to negotiate a loan or something like that. And the bank manager will force you to fill in what was called a balance sheet. What is your monthly expenditure and income? On the basis of that, we know that you are worthy of so much credit. All of that is gone through the window. All you have to do is just go on your laptop and start doing business like that. I think, good old banking is not a bad idea. And my view is if the chief executive of a big financial institution
doesn't understand these trades that these 25-year-olds are doing, they shouldn't allow it. If you don't understand what is being traded, why do you allow it? And, you know, and I also don't fully understand all of this. Nice products being sold, despite a two-hour lecture by a professor of finance, I still don't understand it. And I wouldn't approve of that had I been one of the leaders of this institution. So I don't think it's a bad idea. But the cost of this transformation is quite substantial. I mean, now we're talking about the possibility of some $700 billion being plowed into the American financial system just to stabilize it. That's not small change at all. Brian is looking at me with a very bad eye. It means that he says I must stop talking and he must start the talking. Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Your take, Prof.
I think there was just the one question that is outstanding, the question of wage settlements and the sustainability of these wage settlements. I think the question was, here we see for 2008 that inflation has exceeded the average rate of wage settlements. Well, the first point to make is that clearly these are average wage settlements. Some settlements would have been lower, some would have been higher. So we have seen in some sectors, for example, the mining sector, you have seen higher wage settlements than in, say, the retail sector, which is under more pressure than and in some of the services sectors. But the question then is this sustainable? That can we expect a further increase in wage settlements next year? And I think the answer is that, well, it's something that we'll have to see, but the wage settlements do take place with a lag. They happen once a year. There are also multi-year agreements, which means that not all settlements take happen a year. It's been decided in advance. So it's very possible that even if inflation does come down next year, we may see an increase in wage settlements next year. But a lot will depend on the ability of companies to be able to pay these higher nominal increases. If we look at what happened in 2002, I think that's a good indication that in 2002, when inflation went up unexpectedly, we saw that wage settlements lagged behind actual inflation. And in the following year, we saw higher wage settlements, even though inflation had come down. So we may see a little bit of that happening, but the big difference between 2003 and now is that the economy was on the beginning of a growth phase in that year. It was the beginning of the strong growth phase of over 5% that we had. Whereas now we have some sectors of the economy that are slowing down quite a lot. But, for example, as we saw, manufacturing, for example. So I think there still will be pressure from the unions for higher nominal wages next year. But whether or not they will exceed the actual inflation that we've seen this year will depend on how healthy certain sectors are and whether they'll be able to pay.
So I'm left with five more hands, and time really isn't on our side anymore. Mr. Mguni.
Thanks, Chair.
And I'm limiting members to one question now.
Okay, I'll make it one, Chair. It's in relation with the on page 31 of the bulletin on banks. Banks' mortgage advances were also reduced when one of the reporting banks transferred part of its mortgage book to non-banks and subsidiary on page 81 of the bulletin. My question here is that At some stage, the governor said he is actually quite happy when banks securitize their, or they call the securitization anyway, because that's the way they clear their books and they'll be clean. My question is, as we've seen, this is a subprime thing. The banks, as the governor just said, that they don't want to do anything with these securitized assets or whatever, derivatives they call it. Now, my question is, does the governor still think that is the right way to securitize those things and then put them there? Aren't they running the risk, you know, of running out of the radar screen of the Reserve Bank to check if there are any risks to the financial stability? As also in page 31, when the mortgages are being given to non-banking subsidiaries, are they going off the radar screen of the Reserve Bank to check if there are going to be the risk to our financial stability? Thanks, Chair.
Mr. Malatlhelo.
Thanks, Chair President. My question is neither textbook orientated or coming from the presentation. It's a follow-up from a question posed by one of our colleagues a year and a half earlier, Honorable Bamchi, on the structural relations between the Reserve Bank and Parliament as an institution, which question prompted both yourself and the governor to then say you would sit and jot something down in relation to your thoughts about that paradigm shift. It's not necessarily to put you on the spot, but it's also to say then, is there progress that has been made in relation to that aspect? Just to give you flesh about what the thoughts were at that point, whether to still need the Reserve Bank that would come to the Committee of Finance and Intact as we do now, or you might want a situation where you might have a separate sort of banking financial or banking committee in finance, I mean in Parliament, which would also prompt the changing of the rules of Parliament and so on and so forth. So that the engagement does not necessarily just become academic, it also gets in depth to that which is taking place. I just wanted to check whether there's been progress in that regard. Thanks.
Okay. We'll deal with that at the end of the process. Mr. Murray?
Thank you, Chair. I just want to ask to the Governor, I mean, we know that you have, everybody was concerned about household debt and expenditure. Are you happy that you've reached your objectives by increasing interest rates to contain that? Can we see a moderation of repo rate and maybe a reduction? If you can give me your opinion on that. And then, in terms of, I mean, we know that the deficit, to fund the deficit, we are very much dependent on short-term and portfolio foreign investments. And to what extent will that be compromised? Because we know that foreign investors are looking for a return, and your competitive edge is that price differential. And I know that in the past you have said that you will not be guided by foreign or outside influences and factors. But to what extent is that important? Because it is clearly is important to have that price differential to still draw that short-term and portfolio investment to fund that. And then thirdly, in terms of my first question that you have said, I don't know. I just want to follow up on that one, on the underlying inflation based on the January 09 formula and composition. I mean, do you consider that currently when you look at repo rates? Because that is the real underlying inflation. Or does that not even, don't you even consider that at the moment? Thank you, sir.
How did you manage to ask two questions? Mr. Singh?
Thank you, Chair. My first one is going to be a comment, the second one a question. So there's one question. On page 6, Governor, you spoke about where there's a graph on final consumption expenditure, and there's reference to a submarine that was purchased, probably at billions or hundreds of millions of dollars. Now, how can that be classified as consumption expenditure, the submarine? And are there any other items of such magnitude that are classified consumption? Secondly, the Fitch rating agency yesterday, I think, downgraded First Rand Bank from an A to an A-minus or an A to a triple B. Now, will this have any implication for the banking sector in general or for the economy? Any comments from your side on that? Thank you.
Dr. George, don't follow the example of these two gentlemen.
I won't, Chair. Thank you. I just to follow up on my question about the factors influencing the value of the rand. And the response was what I already know, is that there are many factors that influence the rand. But my question was, what are the immediate term influences? Now, my understanding would be that the Reserve Bank, with its eye on protecting the value of the currency, would be aware what those factors are. So I'm just not sure whether my question was properly understood or whether the answer is no, the bank does not know what is the immediate influence, what factors are immediately influencing the rand. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks. And the last is Mr. Molato. Chair, mine's a follow-up on my first question on the use of lender of last resort. My real question was the experiences that we as South Africa can learn from that. Let me put it this way, Governor. Let's shift the roles around. I'll ask a quick question. I'm the Governor of the Reserve Bank of South Africa, and you are a consultant.
He's staging a coup d'etat.
No, for the purpose of my question, Chair. I'm a governor of the Reserve Bank of South Africa, and you are a consultant hired for a fee. I'm saying, Governor, there's this issue that has happened in the U.S. Give me an advice. I mean, you are a consultant, and I'm a governor. Give me an advice in terms of constructing my surveillance system. What are the early warning signs before I can even start to talk about using the land of last resort? Because certain things happened before. That can use you can invoke the use of a land of last resort. There are certain things possibly that were overlooked, and for a fee, I'm saying, give me that type of advice. Chair, the governor said he's a high priest of monetary policy. There's a book that I would recommend to the governor called The Secrets of the Temple, which is a critique of Paul Volcker. So I'm not sure whether you still want to be a high priest of monetary policy.
Yeah, that's it, Governor.
Thank you very much. I think it's much safer to be the high priest of monetary policy than to be somewhere else. Let me start with that question of the land of last resort. I have indicated that central banks are obviously, in terms of the textbook, seen as the lenders of last resort. But they must not be the lenders of last resort for foolish actions by private bankers. And private bankers need to know that they have a responsibility to their shareholders and their clients to maintain good management standards and that greed and foolishness does not help. After you squandered your shareholders' assets, you can't say, I will always go to the central bank. Now, but at the same time, central banks have a difficulty in that you don't go around saying to the private banks, I'll be the lender of last resort, I'll be the lender of last resort. But on the other hand, you know that when dust hits the fan, you have to make the judgment about what is likely to happen to the financial system if one or the other action is taken or not taken. It's a judgment call. And the central bankers have to be held accountable for that. Now, and we can discuss a lot about a moral hazard. That thing goes out of the window very quickly when you have to confront a situation where Northern Rock has just collapsed, and last week you talked about moral hazard. It doesn't work, and suddenly you have to forget about your theoretical discussions and do something practical about rescuing the institution. It's the same thing about nationalization. Who ever thought the British government in the year 2008 would nationalize a bank? But it did. And so, for all intents and purposes, AIG in the US has been nationalized by the Republican Party government. So, dogma doesn't help. One has to be practical in looking at these different situations. And I think that's why I'm saying, imagine here in South Africa if we're going to accept student loan books as collateral. You folks here would burn me at the stake. You say, what wrong has happened to this fellow? He's of unsound mind. Maybe we should impeach him. Remove him from office. Because he's accepting student loans as collateral. And credit cards and shares and so on. So I'm trying to indicate that I know Brian Kahn and the other theoreticians on these matters will advise in the theoretical structured way. But as a practical central banker, I'll tell you sometimes these things go out of the window when you have a situation to sort out. Now, the experience in South Africa is that when some banks came to us and said they had liquidity problems, I learned that meant they're bankrupt. They were bankrupt when they said they had liquidity problems. Later I learned that it means that they were insolvent. That's why we took them out of the system. You might recall a couple of years ago, we took quite a number of them out of the system. And we began initially by pumping liquidity into these banks until we noticed that we're trying to assist a dead horse here. So one has to be able to judge. So I'll advise you, since you've taken my job, I'll advise you that you must carefully assess whether this institution is insolvent or is just experiencing temporary liquidity problems. Now, as far as the exchange rate is concerned, you know, one of the things I learned when I joined central banking is that the less the governor of the bank talks about the exchange rate, the better. So I might waffle and mumble and so on, but it's actually not advisable for the governor to talk a lot about the exchange rate. And maybe when you ask questions about the exchange rate, you say, because it's dangerous to do so. I hope you'll bear with me, honorable member. Mr. Mguni says that, what's my view now about securitization? The view now that's prevailing globally is that these banks have to bring all these off-balance sheet items back onto the balance sheet. And that's the experience we've learned over the past while. So, and, you know, I think the Register of Banks is working with our banks as well, you know, in that regard. The structural relations between Parliament and the South African Reserve Bank, I must say, maybe we have not made as much progress as we should have in the written word. But in the interaction, actually, so many things have improved, which I'm very pleased about. I think the question about a special banking committee in Parliament is something that the leadership of Parliament might wish to consider. It's not a bad idea at all. It's not a bad idea. And I think we'll welcome any suggestions from the leadership of Parliament. But I think maybe we should still make some proposals in that regard. The issue of household debt and expenditure, as monetary policy achieved its objectives, let me just re-emphasize that the purpose of monetary policy is to bring inflation into within the target band. That's the key focus. Not household debt and all these things. Our purpose is to bring inflation within the target band. So, you know, as the high priest of monetary policies, you know, sometimes one makes commentary about other things that might lead to or be related to inflation, but I think the key focus must always be what is the impact of monetary policy on inflation. Not household debt. The household debt is the thing that we talk about. You know, Umfundisi, you know, sometimes gets excited and does try and get the people to understand that hell is terrible. Hell is a bad idea. But the purpose for the priest is to try and encourage you to go to church so you can go to heaven. Oh, and the other thing I learned the other day is that governors of central banks go to heaven without dying, which is wonderful. It's really nice. That's why I think I should hang around being governor until the time comes for me to go to heaven. I think it's a good thing. So the focus is on money, is on inflation. And can you show that inflation graph again? The the repurchase rate and... where is that thing? You lost it. Very good. There you are. So, if you were sitting, honorable member, as the Monetary Policy Committee, you'd look at this graph, and you'll be concerned that there's an intersection there between the CPIX inflation and the repo rate. And you'll be able to confidently go to your constituents and say there's a problem there. With confidence. Because you can see you're running into dangerous territory there. If anything, you could argue that monetary policy has been a little bit behind the curve because the repurchase rate should be on more on the left side and not going that way. So if you are really hard monetarist, you'll say the repurchase rate is too low. Because the gap between the repurchase rate and inflation has narrowed and it's going the other way around. So you should be the ones to protect me at the political level. To say the governor is not mad. Can you see that evidence? In fact, he's being too nice, actually. So, in case I get misunderstood, let me not say anything further. The funding of the current account deficit is an important question. It relates to, Brian, can you go to that panel on the balance of payments? It relates to whether South Africans are also investing sufficiently abroad so that we can receive dividends back. No, that one. It's okay. You see the middle panel there. The services income and transfer account is the major culprit. In other words, there's more outflows from that account than inflows. So it's all very nice when there's been new investment in South Africa, everybody celebrates. But it's a purchase of a South African asset which is going to yield long-term dividends to non-residents. And that results in that panel there. Of course, you know, when South African Airways lands somewhere else, we have to pay for that and so on. And then the next culprit is the trade account, which is the first panel. We are not exporting as much as we should to try and offset that permanent problem with the services income and current transfer account. And if you combine those two, you end up with that last panel, which is a current account deficit. Now, how do you finance it? It's a question that we all have to deal with. We need to invest more abroad as South Africans so there can be dividend coming back to South Africa. We need to export more, which is a structural question about our export performance. Again, not within the purview of the bank, but we can comment about it. Can encourage your other colleagues to work hard on that. And and we need to buy more South African goods and stop this fascination about Gucci and all these funny things when we can buy nice bags and shoes here in Cape Town and nice suits and so on from here. This fascination with, I bought this thing in Italy. There's something wrong there. Why can't you buy South African goods? What's fascination about this thing? Anyway, The underlying
Governor, it's made in South Africa from imported material.
I hope. Must
check your label quite closely. Go ahead.
Ducks? What's ducks? It's from here. No, it's from here.
This is local. Local is liquor.
Now, the underlying inflation rate is important for monetary policy decision making. That's why I say we do strip out food and energy to get a sense what is the underlying pressure. And as Brian was saying, if you do that at the moment, the inflation rate is still above 7%, which is a problem. And that's why you must do something to try and correct that situation. About the submarine, it was Brian who made the comment. It was not me. So Brian will explain this. I don't want to say anything about this. Because, you see, I'm an honorary colonel in the tank division of the South African National Defense Force. And we do need some tanks, too. So, and as you know, if people start wars, but it's the tank division that wins them. But it's just Brian. He's going to explain himself. The re-rating of First National Bank, and what does it mean? Well, you know, these rating agencies from time to time have to look into the performance of an institution and do some rating. But out of the U.S. subprime experience, rating agencies have lost faith. Not many people take them seriously anymore, including myself. I don't take them seriously anymore. But I think First National Bank is dealing with this question. Its implication for the South African financial system is, I don't know, but I don't think there will be much of any impact whatsoever. So, Brian and your submarines, there. Thank you very much.
Brian, last one. Very briefly deal with the consumption expenditure question. This is simply a convention that is set out by the system of national accounts of the IMF. So every country that subscribes to that system of national accounts has to classify different types of expenditure under different categories. It so happens that military equipment is categorized as consumption expenditure, maybe on the argument that this stuff is going to be destroyed anyway. But it's not regarded as an investment expenditure. There's no return from it, for example, if you have a machine that produces something. That is the way it is categorized. It's as simple as that.
Okay. Somebody has to foot the bill for public good. Thank you. Yes, thanks, Governor and your team. That brings us to the end of this session. We look forward to further engagements with yourselves before the end of our term.